Good morning, Laurel.
Ah, there she is.
Good.
Pretty good.
And Betty, good morning. Okay, so let's call to order the June 10th virtual Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. Chris, do you want to call the roll?
Mr. Anderson?
Not yet.
Okay, Ms. Blair?
Present.
Ms. Cantu?
Present.
Dr. Olson?
Present.
Mr. Strawn?
I'm here.
Ms. Warren?
Morning.
And Dr. Bobbernell?
I'm here too.
I'm here as well, Eric.
Oh, where are you?
I don't
there
know.
You are. Hello.
I just brought him over to be a panelist.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Let's consider the adoption of item one is, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. This is the time for our public forum. Is there anybody from the public who wants to address the board on any issue that is not on the agenda? Chris, do you have any, how are you doing it? Are you getting cards or what?
I do not have any speaker cards for the public forum.
Okay. If somebody shows up, we'll interrupt to allow them to speak. Let's move on to the item one, board business. And let's consider the adoption of the minutes of the May 13th, 2020 meeting.
Move approval.
Okay, motion, second?
Second, Betty Olson.
Okay, thank you. Chris?
Mr. Anderson? Mr. Anderson?
He's muted.
Ms. Blair?
Yes.
Ms. Cantu?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Dr. Bobbernell?
Aye.
Minister of Health adopted.
Okay. We'll move on to item two. Eric, are you okay? You're connected by sound now, or?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, sounds good. Let's start with reports of any board members who want to speak on any item. Celeste, would you like to say a few words about the US EPA stakeholder meeting?
Certainly. Chair Bobbernell and Executive Officer Dave Gibson and I met via Zoom with the EPA stakeholders meeting on the Tijuana River flows into the United States. What they laid out is a time frame and a commitment that they wish to move expeditiously, but cautiously and thoroughly in a holistic way. That they are interested in solving this problem once and for all, which I really don't know if that's a possibility, but obviously they're showing a tremendous amount of enthusiasm to go along with the $300 million they have to spend to address this problem. They are going to set up an advisory committee, the interagency committee. I think I'm missing one of the words there, interagency.
Consulting EPA. Or something, yeah.
Advisory committee, yeah. That they will meet with. They've committed to meet with them on a pretty tight basis. They're very much interested in input. They have a commitment to build on existing studies and data. As we know, there's a tremendous amount and a legacy and a history to build on. They're taking all of that into consideration. They relayed quite clearly, including the EPA administrator called in to make a statement that the administrator is gung-ho to solve this problem, and everybody is lined up to do so. So I think it was a good meeting. I am hopeful for the future. They're moving about this in a very systemic way, and I appreciate that.
May I add a comment? I agree with everything Celeste said about her observations at this stakeholder meeting, but I was a little disappointed that there was no addressing, and maybe it's because it's the United States EPA, of how one is going to face problems on the other side of the border. And I gather from Dave's mini history over the last weeks that that's always been a difficult problem, because we're dealing with a foreign country and the way that they govern themselves. There were two people, I believe, Dave, from the North American Development Bank. I didn't remember their names because there were 80 people on the call. I barely remembered my own name. And anyway, at this, I think the first meeting of this three-letter committee that we cannot remember will be in June or July. I mean, it's very quick, as Celeste said. Maybe we can ask about what the role of the North American Development Bank will be, if any. Anyway, that was a puzzle to me.
Well, I think EPA, like they have traditionally done, will coordinate with North American Bank. They rely on them a lot. Calexto and some of their Lobos Cordova were on the call. Neither of them said anything. I mean, they weren't scheduled to actually speak. I got the impression from Tomas's presentation that they would definitely consider a solution that included construction activities in Tijuana or in Baja California. The impression I got was that they feel that the dollars could go further there than on this side of the border, but they made no commitment that there's been no decision that the investment will be on this side or in the Baja California side. So that's yet to be examined. Mm-hmm. They also said that it is their desire to spend the $300 million on the Tijuana flow solution, but it's not allocated that way. It could be legally spent along the border in any of the Region 9 area, the EPA Region 9 area. But that it is their desire to use that money in Tijuana, in San Diego County.
Do you recall whether, and Dave, you may know, do they have the authority to spend that money in Mexico? Some of it.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Yes, indeed. And indeed, if they so chose, Congress didn't direct them to spend it only in EPA Region 9. They could also have spent it in EPA Region 6 and faced a lot of pressure to do so, because these types of issues are extant all along the border. So we were very grateful to see that they heeded the board's request in its resolution last December and that of the other agencies, and not only focused on the Tijuana River watershed, but also included, at least at the top of their bullet list, the board and the other agencies' priority project of a U.S. site diversion and treatment system. Mm-hmm. But they can indeed spend the money in Mexico and or in the U.S. as they decide, based on the results of the scope of work and investigation that they're about to start.
Can you remind me and the rest of the board what Senate Bill 507 is? It was talked about a lot. It's when they say Senate Bill 507, we're talking about the California Senate, not the DC Senate, right? What does that bill do? What does it direct us or ask EPA to do?
Senator Hueso's bill, Senate Bill 507, provided funding to the County of San Diego to do a comprehensive evaluation of projects in the Tijuana River watershed to address the transboundary flows. These were a combination of border infrastructure type projects and local projects on the U.S. side to address the impacts. They came up with about 27 projects in the course of that, The number one being the priority that the board identified with the local agencies of a 163 million gallon per day diversion and treatment system attached to the U.S. international border and the U.S. IBWC treatment plant. The other 26 projects were combinations of sediment, trash, and waste and industrial wastewater interception and treatment options, as well as a couple of site cleanup approaches and public education projects as well. But the primary focus was on intercepting and diverting the transboundary flows of wastes.
Mm-hmm. Was that San Diego County product on behalf of all of the other cities in the county? And did it consider the rest of our Region 9, Southern Orange and Southern Riverside counties?
It considered the border area from in the San Diego region. And it did include a very robust stakeholder approach that included all of the municipalities, those who are litigants in the current actions against IBWC, and those who are not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions for Celeste or Dave or me? My impression, this is personal, although I thought from comments that Celeste made, that Tomas Torres, whose formal position in the EPA, I forget, he's the head of our Region 9, is that correct? No.
No, he has the water desk.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I thought he spoke rather clearly and eloquently and sounded like he had the support of the staff around him. And I have never met the man in person, but I was impressed by him. Okay. Yeah. Are there any questions about that event or reports on other events that any board member would like to talk about?
I'd like to share our next generation monitoring meeting progress. We discussed at the last meeting a time frame that results in a white paper in the beginning of September. So we're hoping in September we'll be able to bring that to this board.
Will you be able to talk to private companies like Descartes Lab, the others? I think Sarah Mayron talked to them, but I have never seen anything reporting on their discussions.
I think, yeah, that will definitely be in the scope of the white paper.
Okay, great. Because I think they and I think the company used to be called Planet Lab and now it's just called Planet.
Yeah.
Right. I guess we also have to deal with Universe Lab and Universe if we want to expand our scope. Okay, Laurel, how are you this morning? Do you want to, where are you?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. Should I start with my state board liaison report? Sure. Thanks for having me. I wanted to go through a few things that are going on at the state board level. I wanted to start with COVID-19 update. We have that as kind of a monthly update, standing item on our board meetings. And so at the last board meeting, there were a couple things that we went over. One is that in an effort to implement the executive order that prohibited water shutoffs during the emergency, the Water Board has two different reporting portals. One is for the public to report if they are experiencing a shutoff or having trouble getting reissuance of water that was shut off after March 4th. And we've only gotten about 12 reports on that. I don't think it's been as widely publicized as we would like in communities that may be experiencing this, but it also, you know, hopefully is also an indicator that this isn't happening a ton statewide. I know water agencies were very proactive before the executive order in, you know, prohibiting this locally themselves voluntarily in many cases. There's also a portal for water agencies to post their information and policies around shutoffs and reissuance of connections. And the state board is going further and wanted and is sending out a survey to water providers to try to understand the impacts on water providers from the COVID-19 emergency. I think we are very sensitive to the need to keep tabs on the needs of water providers with regard to revenue streams that may have been lost that may impact their ability to operate, challenges with operators and sort of backups to operators or access to chemicals or other basic operation needs. And I think especially with small systems. So we'll be sending, if we haven't already, we'll be sending out a letter to every water provider just asking for voluntary reporting of information on challenges and impacts that they've seen in addition to this reporting portal that where they can also report that information as well as shutoff policies. And lastly, the governor issued an order for every agency to allocate 5% of their personnel to act as community tracers for COVID-19. And so that means that 5% of our workforce is now moving away from their water board work to provide this service for the state for a temporary period. And so that 5%, as we understand it from our executive officer, is about 5% from the state board and 5% from regional boards more generally. And what we did is ask for volunteers and tried to do as much through volunteers as possible. But we did have to go beyond that and allocate folks that didn't volunteer. I think also we're very much trying to make sure that it doesn't mean that we can't move forward on our work in any significant way more generally, but it will be an impact on all staff and programs and regions. So wanted to highlight that. A couple things going on within the drinking water program. Coming up in our next board meeting on June 16th, we'll be considering adoption of a definition of microplastics. And so that that's on our agenda. We held a public workshop on that a few board meetings ago. We are also going to be considering the intended use plan for the state revolving fund for both drinking water and clean water state revolving funds. So that is coming up as well. Actually, comments on those are due at noon today, public comments. And then lastly, we did release our draft fund expenditure plan for the SAFER program, Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund, and overall our SAFER program, which is safe and affordable funding for equity and resilience. And so that draft is out for the full fund expenditure plan. We have an advisory group meeting coming up on the 12th, so coming up very soon, to go over that. And there will also be a public Q&A session for the public more generally to ask more questions and get information from staff in addition to the advisory group meeting. On water quality, we have a workshop coming up, a staff level workshop coming up on reissuance of our statewide small MS4 permits, general permit, and that is June 15th through 16th. That's still early in the process, so that's an early opportunity to provide input in the reissuance of that general permit. We also have coming up a workshop on a new section dredge mining regulatory program and PDS permit, and we're expecting a draft of our winery's general order to be coming out to be released in the next month or so. On water rights, we have issued a number of enforcement orders for failure to report. I think there's around 900 going out. We have a number of things going on as a state in general and with the Water Board around curtailment discussions with some correspondence back and forth with the federal Bureau of Reclamation around management of their facilities. There's also quite a lot of litigation going on that I, you know, won't spend a huge amount of time going into, and involves much more than the Water Board at the state level and federal level. But one of the things that we have, we've been looking at temperature management with the Bureau and what that means for flows with federal water coming through our statewide systems of water supply and water rights. And we have an effort just recognizing that we are in drought in some areas, critical drought in Northern California in particular. And that has impacts and implications for the rest of the state. We are hoping that that will not be a multi-year drought, but we are also looking at trying to make sure that we are reflecting on lessons learned from the past multi-year drought, particularly right now. I know water rights is really looking at how to make sure that we're being prepared for how to learn from past droughts. And so that's something that we're doing a lot internally right now. And finally, I was just going to mention that the Secretary of CalEPA, as well as our board chair, also participated in that stakeholder call with EPA to discuss the $300 million and advocate for funding to address the Tijuana River flows. There is still, in terms of budget, there still remains some funding in the proposed budget for a small amount of funding for the New River, which is in Region 7, but also a cross-border flow issue. And that's the hope to finish that project. But there's not additional money allocated in the May revise for Tijuana. And I think that's why this $300 million through the federal government is really critical. Any questions?
I don't have questions. Can we ask questions? Henry, is it okay? Oh, I don't know.
Yes, of course. This is the time.
So I wanted to ask you, it says that tomorrow you're talking about a fee for drinking water on June 12th. Is that, can you elaborate on that? Or
I think maybe that's in, so I'm not sure exactly. I know June 12th we're doing our advisory group meeting around the fund expenditure plan. That does not include a fee on drinking water, but what we do have a fee on drinking water providers for is just our funding for a regulatory program for water providers more generally. And that has been in place for a really long time. It's just part of the
normal fee. Yeah. Okay. That one I've got. So I also wanted to tell you about what Orange County water districts have done in terms of COVID-19. Now, each one is a little bit different in their approach, but the Santa Margarita Water District, which is my water district, has set up a deferred payment plan for residents. Also for commercial entities as well as apartments. Mm-hmm. So we've, and those apartments would be many, many residents with one meter. So We've tried to address that. And we've developed different payment plans. So you can pay it back if you're a resident over through 2021. And then there's similar plans for commercial and apartments in order to be able to accommodate them. So, and the other thing is that you've only had a few, we've only had a few too. So specific, we always have late payers. And not counting those in, we've only had about 31 calls in 62,000 connections. So, so far, so good. And of course, everybody's concerned about this. And
yeah,
basically, so I know all the Orange County water districts have done this. And so hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, of course. No, I think it's really the water agencies that have been leaders on this, and are, you know, the ones both working through the challenges with customers as well as, you know, with their own budgets and bottom line. So, and yeah, really appreciate that leadership. And those are good examples.
And so the other thing I wanted to mention is most of the water boards have not reopened their lobbies.
Right.
And it seems to be, we haven't had any complaints and people can write on the website. And so that may be good for everyone.
Yeah. I think the water boards are really reassessing cautiously how to transition in a way that keeps employees and the public safe and make sure we can continue to provide our services. And I think all of them across the board haven't done, I think are transitioning slowly for some employees, but yeah, have not opened up their offices fully.
And the other thing we did was we divided our, I thought this was a clever idea. They divided the crews. And so one crew just associated with that crew. And therefore, if that crew got sick, we didn't lose all of our crews. So they were individually separated.
Yeah.
Life goes on. Yeah.
Any other questions? So my kids are in the background.
Yeah, that's good. Wow, those are good.
Does Max want to speak?
He has some questions later for Dave during his 10-15 snack, don't worry.
And I have a quick just update. We did have the discussion that we discussed with the ag team and it's proceeding. Some of the implementation, now that the rubber's hitting the road, how to go about herding the many thousand farmers into the irrigated lands or regulations. So, and that's always tough. Thank you.
Are there any other questions of Laurel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to our executive officer's report.
Thank you, Henry. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. A couple of things to go over briefly. As our state board liaison mentioned, we were required to identify 5% of our staff for redirection to a contact tracing for the COVID-19 effort statewide. We've given them three excellent people to help with that, and I really do appreciate their willingness to step forward and to help get us back to work and to help protect the health of the community, even if that wasn't what they joined the water boards to do. About 10,000 employees across the state will be drafted into this effort, and they are going through training even now as we speak, and we anticipate that this will be a 6 to 9 month redirection, and we're really looking forward to their return. Fortunately, we can also today welcome Sasha Smerinsky, an engineering geologist in our site restoration and ag protection unit, and Elizabeth Wynn, office technician in our mission support unit. Very glad to be able to bring them on. We still have one vacancy on the books that right now we are waiting to see if we'll be allowed to move forward. Just so that we can see.
Dave, there's static on your channel or line. Can AGP look at that?
We can't hear you, Dave, just so you know. We can't hear you. It's very staticky and loud.
Yeah, so.
Hang on for 1 second.
It could possibly be the connection with your wireless headset. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it looks like David is having a connection problem. If he can hear us, might try reconnecting.
Give it a try again, Dave. It seems like you might have started moving again.
There we go. Am I back?
Yes.
It's the Surface Pro.
Dave, we're going to have to ask you to start at the start, however, because everything was covered up by static and noise. Sorry.
Yeah. It's still very staticky on this end. I'm very sorry. I think it is this computer itself, which is going back to the owner today. And I'll get a new one. I would like to welcome Sasha Smirinsky to our staff, engineering geologist in our site restoration and ag protection unit. She joined us this month, and Elizabeth Wynn, office technician in our mission support unit. That was the good news. The bad news was we had to redirect three of our staff to the contact tracing effort statewide, which is going to include about 10,000 state employees. We've given them three very good employees to help make that effort very successful so that we can get people back to work and also be sure that the public safety is protected by being able to identify areas where outbreaks have occurred and to control them. So we've given them three very good people. That is expected to last 6 to 9 months, and we're really looking forward to their return. I sent a letter to Regional Administrator Buster Root of Region 9 US EPA and received very graciously a reply. We will be meeting with him and his staff here by the end of the month to talk about our efforts as regulators to deal with the transboundary flows of wastes. Among the issues that we will discuss is how to utilize the existing permit with IBWC to accommodate increased flows into the treatment plant to try to remove some of the flows which are currently being released by CESP, the state agency in Tijuana, into the river rather than being directed through their collection system to San Antonio de los Buenos or to the unaffected areas of their collection system downstream. It's a highly unsatisfactory situation that's taking place down there. And if we can adjust how we administer the permit to accommodate additional flows, we will. But I do think that the emphasis should be on CESP to manage their system properly rather than on the United States to bend over and find a way to accommodate releases to the river, which shouldn't be there. They need to operate their stations 1A and 1B and their PBC of the station to take care of those flows and to redirect their flows from their Collector Poniente project around the affected area rather than simply into the river. But we are working on that, and we'll meet with Regional Administrator Buster Root on our regulatory approach here by the end of this month. I also wanted to mention that a shout out to one of our former staff, Cheryl Prowell, who is now with the Department of Toxic Substances Control. She was one of our graduates from our program. We sent her on to Region 2, and she was the co-chair of the committee that drafted the draft supplemental vapor intrusion guidance that you had in your executive officer's report this month. Excellent work for us with Region 2 and now on to DTSC. And I really appreciate that her contribution to that whole area of work that was reported on in this month's report. Unless there are any questions or follow-up, that concludes my report, although I'll be glad to take Max's question now or offline.
Thank you. I don't know about him, but I have a few questions about the 3 attachments to the executive officer's report. I guess the first is a request. The next time that we have a stakeholder meeting with San Onofre and we're invited to attend, if board members are also allowed to participate in that, I'd like to come along, whether that's virtually or in person, depending on when the next meeting is set. And then turning to the last page of what I believe was their PowerPoint that the folks at San Onofre provided to the attendees of the stakeholders meeting, there's an issue that says DON proposed potential options, and it says agencies issue letters to SoCal Edison deferring in perpetuity to NRC for radiological investigations cleanup and to DTSC for chemical investigations cleanup. Not to put anyone on the spot, but I'd appreciate, I guess, hearing offline or at the next board meeting our position on that request.
We'll include that in the next executive officer's report in August. If you need something more directly, I can communicate with you individually to update you.
No, I think it's good. The August board, I forget we don't have one in July. August board meeting seems fine. Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you.
No more questions of Dave from the Youth Brigade or anyone? Oh, we're still getting that static. Is that
Dave? I think Dave needs to mute his. I think we're hearing the static coming through Dave's computer.
How's that? That's better. Okay, thank you. Okay, that summarizes our reports. We'll move on to item number three, which is time for board members to make suggestions of future agenda items that they would like to see on our board's agenda, not necessarily next week or next month, but anon. Are there any suggestions?
Yeah, Henry, this is Gary. I'm kind of blacked out here for some reason.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I hear you quite clearly.
All right, good. I was turned off by the boss there somehow. This last month at our San Diego River Conservancy meeting, we had a briefing from the three professors from San Diego State that had been tasked with a survey, or I think the Conservancy funded it with Prop 1 maybe, to look at essentially transmission of bacteria through the San Diego River. And specifically, they were looking at that in relationship to active homeless camps activities and also the residual effects after an abandoned camp had been cleaned up. Now, they were going back and seeing how that human bacteria inputs stayed in the area. It was an interesting report. I think it was a preliminary report. The main one isn't out yet, and I suspect I'm stepping on ahead of the game here, because I have a feeling that Dave and our staff has probably already planned to have a briefing on this once that full report comes out. But I just wanted to bring it to everybody's attention and throw in my vote. It was interesting. The end result appeared to be very little impact from the homeless camps. Their latrines are far enough back from the river that they didn't noticeably or in any significant way affect the bacteria levels downstream. The culprits appears to be more in line with sewer spills and septic dumps, that sort of thing. But it was an interesting report. I think it was well done, and I'm sure the rest of the board would be interested in hearing those results. Kind of a precursor to the bigger study that's just getting started, but I guess it's going to take the next 5 years. So anyway, I strongly suggest we get that on the future agenda as soon as that final report is ready for to be publicized.
And Gary, when do you think that might be?
I think a month or so. I think they were.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not that far down the line. And they did, I talked to them specifically. They had been in contact with our staff and were ready to present the report there. So I suspect Kelly or Dave, you probably already know more about this than I do, but I just wanted to throw my vote in on it.
Would we have time? Are we talking about a lengthy report?
No, they did their briefing in probably 15 minutes or something like that. It could be a normal information item.
Can we get their names and see whether they would be available for August or September?
Sure, absolutely. Okay. I'll work with the staff offline if they don't already have it.
Okay, thank you.
I know one is Alicia Kenosha because she does some other work with me, but there's two others and their names escape me right now, but I can get them.
Okay. All right. Any other items for the future? Let's move on then. We have a very light calendar, and then we're going to take a break to switch to Microsoft Teams. Is that correct, Chris? So item number four is a consent calendar item. I guess we don't have any members of the public in, but I can't tell. But does any board member wish to remove this item from the consent calendar and have a full report on it? Seeing none, and
Chair, I believe that we do have one. Oh no, I'm sorry. That's the next item. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No problem. Okay, do we have a motion for item four, which is on our consent calendar?
So moved.
A second? I'll second it. Chris?
Aye. Should we self-roll call? Eric Anderson, aye.
Very strong eye.
I think we need to make sure that it's being recorded, that Chris is capturing it for minutes.
Chris, I believe you're on mute, just in case you are not aware.
This is Catherine. Let's record it for you.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, got it.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Ms. Cantu?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Yeah. Betty, you're on mute. We can't hear you say yes or no.
Aye.
Thank you.
Go. Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
And Dr. Barbernow?
Yes. Okay, thank you. So we have two informational items. Dave, do you want to coordinate them? And is Sarah giving the first report on item number five? Hello? Dave appears to be frozen.
Henry, can I ask a quick question, though? Is there a period? I didn't see it on the agenda. We already did that at the very beginning.
Did one.
Which item are you concerned about, Eric?
The item, it would be our normal public comment.
Nobody appeared. We asked for
just making sure.
Yeah, no, we covered that, but there was nobody there. Okay. Dave, who is Dave? Dave, are you there? Kelly?
Yes, I will take over.
Thank you.
Yes, you got it. So, board and board members and chair, we're here. Item number five is an informational item about per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS. You've probably heard of them. It's an update on the statewide investigation. And Sarah Mirren of your staff will be presenting along with, hold on just one second, pulling out my notes. along with two state board folks. I'm sorry. I apologize. This was not.
Yeah, we have.
I was going to do this. Here we go. Annalisa Kihara, Wendy Link, from the Division of Water Quality at State Board, and I'll turn it over to, I believe, Sarah.
Hi, this is Annalisa Kihara with the State Board. Can you hear me okay? Great. And then can
yes, we can. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, no problem at all. Chair Barbanel and members of the board, as well as State Board Member Firestone, good morning. My name is Annalisa Kihara with the Division of Water Quality at the State Water Board. First off, I just want to thank you all for the opportunity on behalf of our team to share our Water Board PFAS, per and polyfluoroalkyl alkyl substances action statewide. Can we move to the next slide, please? Thank you. So while there will be three of us presenting on this item today, myself, Wendy Link with the Division of Water Quality at the State Water Board, and Sarah Miron with the Regional Water Quality Control Board, I'd just also like to introduce the team behind the Zoom scenes who are available as well to assist in answering any questions. That includes Shala Farnock with the Division of Water Quality at the State Water Board, Jeff O'Keefe with the Division of Drinking Water at the State Water Board, Roger Mitchell with the Regional Board Groundwater Protection Branch, and Sean McLean with the Regional Water Board Site Restoration and Military Facilities Unit. Next slide, please. So today I'm going to provide a broad overview of PFAS and why we are concerned about it from a human health and environmental protection perspective. I'll also cover the regulatory framework for the State Water Board's PFAS initiative, and then I'll pass it along to Wendy Link, who will provide a summary of the existing statewide investigative orders that we've issued in collaboration with the regional water boards, where for this effort, the primary objective is to identify PFAS in drinking water supplies, and a secondary objective is to identify those potential source areas across the state. So an overall kind of review of the upcoming actions, Wendy will also share that. So as a general status update, for this effort and the statewide effort, we have received about 50% of the data. And so that's complete in terms of the source investigations. However, more data will be received throughout this year and into 2021. And then on the drinking water side, which Wendy will cover as well, we are complete. I believe we received the fourth quarter data recently. So the data that we're collecting will be used to guide watershed assessments or site-specific actions by the regional water boards, which is a great segue to our third presenter, Sarah Miron, who will share some preliminary results from sites located in the San Diego Regional Board area as well. Next slide, please. So PFAS are a group of constituents of emerging concern and are a major focus for environmental evaluation. According to US EPA, there are more than 6,300 individual compounds that are of interest to scientists and regulators worldwide. PFAS have been in use since the 1940s and have found their way into many commercial and industrial applications nationwide and worldwide. So PFAS have been found in the environment and in the blood of humans and animals worldwide. And studies do show that most people in the United States have one or more specific PFAS in their blood. So there are two analytes, PFOS and PFOA, PFAS and PFOA, of interest within this large class of compounds. And they've been studied the most because they've been used the most. Health-based studies do indicate that PFAS and PFOA have cancer and non-cancer health effects. So interestingly, though, PFAS and PFOA, those two compounds, have been phased out of production in the U.S. In 2002 for PFAS and in 2015 for PFOA. Studies of the U.S. population do show that since those actions took effect, we have seen a decline in the amount of PFAS and PFOA in the U.S. population, except in areas that have environmental contamination. Next Next slide, please. Okay, so PFAS are used in a wide range of commercial and industrial processes and products. This is due to the unique surface tension properties that they impart. That includes oil and water repellency, temperature resistance, friction reduction. So on this slide, what we show are some of the well-known uses, including Class B firefighting foams, such as aqueous film-forming foam, also known as AFFF, as well as a certain metal plating operations, textiles, tech industry, nonstick cookware, and even in food packaging. So it's in just about everything. So the Water Board's statewide PFAS investigations have focused initially on potential sources associated with the use of AFFF for fire response activities, as well as chromium plating facilities where PFAS may have been used as a mist suppressant in plating baths. Additionally, there have been a focused effort on municipal waste landfills, which are the recipients of PFAS-containing waste. Wendy Link will provide additional details regarding these efforts later in this presentation. Next slide, please. Okay, so while we do know that there are at least 6,000 PFAS compounds used in various products, as we show that in the last slide, this image really illustrates what we currently know about PFAS. And this is based on standard laboratory analytical methods currently available to us. So what we could find in samples is that little black box there in terms of the world that we recognize is out there potentially. Next slide, please. And so for the little that we can find, it's still a concern. So from an environmental perspective, the historical use and discharge of PFAS to the environment has led to several concerns. They have been found to be very persistent and do not biodegrade in the environment, which is why some people refer to them as forever chemicals. Many of the ones we have focused on are also extremely mobile, and this has led to widespread occurrence of PFAS globally. With regard to toxicity, there are certain PFAS that have been shown to be bioaccumulative with half-lives in the human body measured in years. And this is a concern because of the potential associated cancer, non-cancer, and development health effects. Next slide. So to be more precise, as summarized by the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, studies do suggest that certain PFAS may affect growth, learning, and behavior of infants and older children. They may lower a woman's chance of getting pregnant, interfere with the body's natural hormones, increase cholesterol, affect the immune system, and increase the risk of cancer. Scientists are still learning about the health effects of exposure to several individual PFAS, as well as exposure to mixtures, which is very important because we typically detect multiple PFAS in environmental media. So we won't just find one, we'll find, I guess we call it a soup. Next slide, please. So this is a list of the common exposure pathways, most of which are related to ingestion of PFAS, such as by drinking contaminated drinking water, eating fish caught from contaminated water, eating contaminated foods, such as fruits grown with contaminated ag water, or food wrapped in PFAS-containing packaging. We're also exposed to PFAS through ingestion or inhalation of contaminated soil or dust, and also through the various consumer products that are made or treated with PFAS, such as carpets, rugs, stain and water-resistant clothing, and several other products. So the drinking water pathway is of the most concern to us because several studies do show that populations that are drinking contaminated water have elevated levels of PFAS in their blood serum compared to the general population. Next slide, please. So PFAS has been shown to be toxic to aquatic organisms as well. Several studies do show that there are reproductive and developmental effects such as infertility, reduce survival and reduce growth for certain aquatic species that are exposed to PFAS. And because PFAS bioaccumulates and will biomagnify up the food chain, seabirds and marine mammals have been shown to accumulate high concentrations of PFAS, and therefore they may be more impacted by PFAS in the environment. Next slide. So at Cal EPA, under the Cal EPA umbrella, we recognize that we have various regulatory tools. There are six sister boards, departments, and offices listed here, including the California Water Boards. This team will meet monthly and coordinate and communicate on various PFAS-related efforts. So One team that was recently created is a team looking at grouping the various PFAS compounds based on common factors and characteristics, which is really important work because, as I had mentioned, there's about 6,000 plus that we know is out there. But if there's a way that we can group these chemicals, maybe what we can do is we don't necessarily have to detect all 6,000, but we can kind of understand based on commonalities how they're affecting human health and our ecosystems. A couple of additional efforts that I just did want to touch on is that our Department of Toxic Substances Control, DTSC, through their Safer Consumer Product Program, they're currently looking at PFAS in carpets and rugs, whether or not it's possible to find safer alternatives, and if so, what they can be. CalRecycle is also looking at PFAS in compostable plastic or fiber-containing food packaging. Next slide. So back to the water boards. As part of these investigations, it is a collaborative effort between our drinking water group as well as our water quality group that includes the Division of Water Quality and the regional boards. For the drinking water side, the Division of Drinking Water, they implement the tools that they have under the Health and Safety Code. And so they're leading the investigations to assess impacts to drinking water supplies. Some of the tools that they implement are developing and issuing notification levels and response levels for any exceedances in samples, drinking water samples. And the Division Drinking Water can also establish regulatory maximum contaminant levels based on public health goals. And these public health goals are recommendations from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard and Assessment, OEHA. Under the Division of Water Quality and the regional boards, we are leading the non-drinking water investigations and issuing water quality investigative orders per our water code authorities. One box there, the orange box, is our environmental laboratory accreditation program. So both groups are collaborating with ELAB just to ensure that any samples and any data that we collect are of high quality. Next slide, please. I think I lost. Do you see the presentation slides?
No.
No, okay.
Chris, are you still there? Looks like we're having some connectivity issues today. Let me see what I can do to find the slides and get them up on the presentation.
This is Jesse with AGP Video. I'm sorry, are we having an issue here?
The presentation from Annalisa vanished.
I think Chris is no longer logged in. I don't see her.
Annalisa, can you try sharing your screen again? Have you tried that?
I do not have the slides up on my screen, but I can pull it up.
Maybe that would be a good workaround.
Okay.
I think they were on Chris Blank's screen. She was the sharer. Share S.
And Chris dropped off.
Chris, yeah.
They're okay.
Are they up? Oh, they are. Okay, perfect.
There's a low contrast version of the first slide. That's it.
Oh, well, maybe they're loading.
Okay.
It says PowerPoint is not responding, so and Elisa, were you sharing those?
I was not. It looks like Roger Mitchell was sharing his screen.
That's correct. I'm trying to get that presentation loaded myself.
Oh, thank you, Roger. Perfect. So, Roger, if you can maybe go down to slide 13. Perfect. Okay. So this timeline summarizes the regulatory and investigative actions taken by US EPA and the water boards. Our statewide source investigation timeline in collaboration with the drinking water investigation started in March of 2019. Wendy will again cover this in the next couple of slides. As you can see on here, there has been much more progress with the two analytes that I had mentioned earlier, PFOS and PFOA, that have been used nationwide as well as been phased out of the US. Last August, the Division of Drinking Water lowered the public water system notification levels for PFOA and PFOS. And then most recently in February, the Division of Drinking Water lowered the response levels to 10 and 40 parts per trillion. And so that lowering means that, you know, where there's a detection of PFOS and PFOA in a running four-quarter average above that response level, the well that the samples were taken from, or well, the results must be reported to the public within 30 days or the water source removed from use. Next slide, please. So while we're in the process of investigating the other PFOS analytes in California, there is a separate effort for PFOA and PFOS, since there's a lot of information and data out there. So the orange circles describe the actions under the purview of our Office of Environmental Health Hazard and Assessment, OEHA, who are drafting these public health goals for public comment and final release. So I think the last timeline we received is we should expect a draft of these public health goals this summer. And then after public comment and just that process of finalizing them in 2021, the summer of 2021. At that point, the green circles highlight the water boards as the lead for drafting maximum contaminant levels for public comment and release. Next slide. And so at this point, I'm going to pass it on to Wendy Link. She's going to provide additional information in terms of our statewide regulatory efforts.
Good morning, everybody. I hope everybody's well. Thank you very much for allowing us to speak today. I'm going to go over the investigatory efforts in regards to our orders that we sent out back in 2019 and some future investigations that are planned for 2020. We're going to talk about the public water supply data, and then we'll go into the non-drinking water data a little bit, and then some highlights of the data and results that we have seen so far preliminarily. So what you see now right here is a map, a statewide map of all the orders and the locations of the sites where issued orders in 2019. It includes landfills, it includes airports, chrome plating facilities, and the public water system, wells that were systems that are adjacent to those locations. The whole idea and the primary objective is to understand what our impacts to drinking water are. We need to understand what additional areas that we need to focus on, whether they're watersheds or specific source identification that results from this initial set of data that is coming in. Additional public water supply well sampling, of course, is going to be a follow-on to this. And all of this data is being used to inform OEHA in the generation of public health goals and maximum contaminant levels. So next slide, please. So let's talk about the public water supply sampling. In 2019, there was an issuance of orders issued to almost 200 public water systems. These were selected as part of unidentifying the locations where we knew there was most likely sources of PFAS. One, at airports because of the use of AFFF. At landfills because the disposal of domestic and industrial waste. And also because of the efforts back in 2013 and 2015 by the US EPA for the UCMR3 program. So public water supply was sampled within 2 miles of the airports, 1 mile of landfills, and all the detections of the UCMR3 sampling and wells within a radius of those. The sampling is complete, and the last quarter of data is going to be released soon. Next slide, please. Now that data is available on the Water Board's website. We have 3 data releases available there. There are interactive maps available and other tools to look at that data. Next slide, please. There should be a map showing there, but there is not. So you'll have to, yep, that's the slide. So you'll have to imagine one on that slide. But if you do go to the Water Board's PFAS website, there's maps there in order to look at the water supply data in detail. So I will go on to the next slide. So that was the public drinking water system. For the non-drinking water side, as I mentioned before, we issued orders to the airports, municipal solid waste landfills, and chrome plating facilities in 2019. You can see the number of orders that were sent out. All the large and middle-sized airports received an order. All active municipal solid waste landfills who have a current monitoring and reporting program, which means they already have monitoring wells there for sampling. You can see that the list of media that were sampled, all the way from groundwater, soil, leachate, stormwater, and the chrome plating facilities are in a different realm. They're actually going to be sampling the effluent wastewater as well. Next slide, please. So this map appeared, which is good news. We have a mapping tool that's on the same Water Board's website so that you can look at all of the data together. Right now, it's all the non-drinking water data. We're hopeful in July, we're doing some retooling behind the scenes and coding. It'll soon also show all the drinking water data in one spot. It's a very unique tool for us that we know of across the country. We are actually showing all data in one location. Doesn't matter if it's soils, surface water, groundwater, leachate. It'll all be in one location so that you can see kind of relative differences and where the source areas are or may not be. Next slide. So we have been working and collaborating with the Department of Defense for quite a while now, and just want to reiterate the efforts that the Department of Defense has been doing. They have been investigating PFAS since 2014. They have investigated almost most or all of their sites for the protection of their staff and their servicemen. It's always been an utmost priority to them to make sure that they are also drinking clean water as well. There are about 60 bases within the state of California. They're identified on this map that they are either in one phase or another of investigation for PFAS, whether they're doing a preliminary assessment or they're actually doing soil and groundwater sampling investigative process right there. But ultimately, they have identified all locations, and this includes nationwide, and they are protecting those that are working on those bases if it is their drinking water is exceeding the EPA's lifetime health advisory of 70 ppt. They are providing potable water, or they're making changes to the system and blending in order to make sure that they are not exceeding that lifetime health advisory for PFOA and PFAS at this point in time. Next slide, please. So I have two more to go. I'm going to talk about a little bit of the highlights of the preliminary data and then our PFAS actions for 2020 and 2021. This is just based upon we have currently only about 50% of the data in right now. So these are really highlights here. I want to emphasize that on the public water supply, those folks, when we started out, there was, I say, about 600 water systems or so that the wells within those water systems are sampled. Since every quarter, those public water systems have been voluntarily sampling their wells, so the data sets keep getting bigger and bigger, which is a great thing. And so within the last quarter, and I don't know what the answers are for the fourth quarter, but the third quarter, there are 300 additional wells that were voluntarily sampled, so that's great. On the non-drinking water side, we're not quite complete in the data, and we won't have the rest of the data until the end of this year into early next year. But based upon those results, we are seeing PFAS in groundwater at the airports and landfills. But please keep in mind that these investigations were meant to be at the source locations. They were at the releases of the AFFF. They were, you know, within the leachate of the groundwater, all the locations that we'd expect to see PFAS. So the results are showing that, that we are nearly, you know, we're seeing a lot of PFAS. So the drinking water supply and the non-drinking water supply, we have some commonalities that we are seeing the same compounds within both both sides. Not necessarily we can't make connections yet, but we are seeing that there are the similar compounds that are seeing in both, all of them. Because the non-drinking water side, we're analyzing for a larger set of analytes that's available. So we're seeing a lot more compounds than on the drinking water side. The drinking water side has to analyze for a certain method. And on the non-drinking water side, we have a little bit more of a flexibility in that realm. So next slide, please. And after this, I'll hand it off to Sarah to finish up and to kind of give you a showing of kind of the preliminary data that's being seen in your San Diego area. So as we mentioned, we're going to continue sampling outwards to identify more of the impacted public water supplies. We are working with the regional boards to focus on water-based or watershed-based source and other public water system investigations. This year, we'll be sending out orders to about 300 wastewater treatment plants, and they will be sampling influent, effluent, biosolids. We need to understand what is coming in and out of those systems because, unfortunately, they are not treating the PFAS. We also need to find out other source locations of AFFF use that are used at refineries and bulk fill terminals. They all have emergency fire suppression systems and then emergency releases, just like an airport and their use of their AFFF. We need a working on domestic water sampling and working with the regions in regards to those areas that may be impacted. And we continually to use data analysis and visualization tools to be able to inform the public. And as part of that, we're hoping to integrate the data we're hoping to receive from the Department of Defense into that information. So I will hand it off next to Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wendy and Annalisa. So I'm going to give a little summary of some of our Region 9 data. Is the slide showing on your screen?
Only a slice of the top.
Loaded.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing too.
Give me a quick moment here and I'll see if I can find a better slide for this.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm glad I'm not the only one having difficulties today, but I'm hoping for a smoother transition to our next meeting in August.
Just a moment, I found a presentation that will be starting shortly.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
Just a quick question while we're getting... I didn't notice that there wasn't much ag contamination. PFAS isn't really used widely in agriculture other than packaging?
Correct. There's not much that we know of that PFAS is used in pesticides or any other type of use in agriculture, except for, let me take that one thing back. We are going to be looking into when the orders are sent to the public, to the wastewater treatment plants, they will be telling us where they're sending their biosolids to. And we do know from other studies that there can be a high concentration of PFAS in biosolids. So once we have an understanding on where all that is going, then some focused investigations can work in that direction. Did I answer the question?
No, she didn't back in.
Okay, so we'll continue. Region 9 has been overseeing work being done under the airport and landfill investigative orders since they were issued in 2019. And as the State Board mentioned, the Navy has also been conducting parallel PFAS investigations, which I will also touch on one particular case in our region. Again, please just keep in mind that the data we are showing today is preliminary. So first we'll start out with the airports. Two airports in the region received the order in 2019. The McClellan Palomar Airport in North County and San Diego International, located just north of downtown near San Diego Bay. So for this presentation, I'd like to focus your attention on San Diego International. sampling was conducted in four distinct areas of the airport suspected of having used PFAS, which are shown here in the four colors and in the legend below. So the highest concentrations were found in two of these areas, the former firefighting training area, shown in green, and the current AFFF testing area in yellow. The concentrations in these areas are orders of magnitude above the PFOA and PFAS response levels. The remote fueling facility down gradient, shown in orange, had relatively low concentrations that are below the response levels. The airport is located in a non-beneficial use area, which means that groundwater is not designated for municipal or domestic use. Accordingly, there are no drinking water wells in the vicinity. San Diego Bay, however, is a potential ecological receptor that, as you can see on the slide, is located just a few hundred feet from the airport. Therefore, additional work may be needed to verify that PFAS is not migrating to the bay. Next slide, please. Next, we have an example of an landfill in our region. Region 9 had requested that all closed and operating landfills receive the order in 2019. So ANZA, shown on your screen, is an example of one of our closed, unlined landfills. And it operated from the mid-50s until the 90s. It's located in a rural area of Riverside County that is classified by Cal EnviroScreen as severely disadvantaged. The groundwater is designated for agricultural use as well as drinking water supply. The landfill is outlined, it's sort of pale green in the middle of the screen. And the circle is a 1 mile radius around the landfill, the blue circle. The wells that were sampled under the order are shown in orange along with their concentration data. And the numbers shown here are the cumulative data for all the PFAS detections. So the concentrations here are lower by about an order of magnitude than those at the airport, but they are still well above the response levels. You will also see on the map there's three public water supply wells to the north within the 1 mile radius of the landfill. There are also not shown on the map about 120 domestic drinking water supply wells within this 1 mile radius. And about 30 of those are down gradient of the landfill, which is to the southwest. So as the State Water Board continues its statewide PFAS investigations and regulatory thresholds are developed, monitoring programs at sites like these may be amended to incorporate PFAS constituents. Next slide, please. So finally, we're going to show an example of one of the Department of Defense sites within the region. The Navy has been conducting a parallel process to the State Board to investigate the presence of PFAS in groundwater. Preliminary assessments have been completed for most of the Naval and Marine Corps bases located within our region. The primary objective of these assessments was to research and assess potential impacts from the use and storage of substances potentially containing PFAS on the base properties. A secondary objective was to identify land use within 1 mile of the base and to identify all the drinking water sources within these areas. So currently site investigations are ongoing and they will continue through 2022 with a focus on PFAS areas identified in these preliminary assessments. So an example of these efforts is Marine Corps Base.
Looks like we may have lost Sarah's connection here, but this is Roger Mitchell. I'm the acting branch chief for the Groundwater Protection Unit. And I can go ahead and continue on with Sarah's presentation and wrap that up for you. What Sarah was going to continue on and say is part of the efforts that are ongoing at Camp Pendleton, which you've already heard today from Wendy, was that the water that's being supplied for the base through the on-site wells are going to a central treatment plant where the water's being treated and tested for use. and water that is identified as being high above the current advisory levels is being blended with clean water to go ahead and reduce those levels to make sure that the water supply that's being provided to the base personnel is protective of human health. So that concludes our presentation. We'd like to go ahead and open it up and see if any of the board members have any questions for us.
Are there any questions of any of our three speakers? Yep. Betty? Betty, please. Betty, you're on mute. You have to unmute yourself. Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask, the blue wells, are you going to be testing those wells that you saw? I mean, that were shown on the two maps? I know you talked about wells downstream of the site, ANZA, I believe, but in Camp Pendleton, there were blue wells shown. Do we have Wendy, or we lost Wendy?
Sarah or Wendy, would you like me to answer this question? This is Jeff O'Keefe from the State Water Board Division of Drinking Water.
Yes, please. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
The Camp Pendleton site is being voluntarily monitored. And as mentioned by, I think it was Sean, there's monthly monitoring occurring at the combined entry point for those wells. They did take several wells offline that had very high results. Right now, they're controlling it by blending, but I believe more action is needed to reduce the levels even further. And we'll continue to work with the base on that. On the landfill site, you asked about the three dots that were in blue. I should just mention these monitoring orders that were issued from the Division of Drinking Water were issued by each district office. We have 24 districts and 14 physical locations. What we did was we generated a list of candidates for the orders based on proximity to landfills, airports, and other prior monitoring results that showed detections. Those three wells shown on the map, two of them are, well, they all belong to a small water utility named Ramona Water Company, and that's not to be confused with the Ramona Municipal Water System. Ramona Water Company serves 250 customers. Those three wells, two are inactive and not in use for drinking water. The third was reviewed by the district office to, you know, ground truth. The locations were accurate. Any other local knowledge about that location. What they determined at the district office was that the depth of the well, which is approximately 250 feet, is above the surface elevation of the landfill because it's a very hilly area. So we determined that those wells being northeast and up gradient to the landfill site and at a higher elevation, we determined that they were not likely vulnerable to any contamination from the landfill. And we did that type of review to make sure, especially these small utilities, didn't incur excessive monitoring costs. These samples can cost over $500 each. And if you add blanks, et cetera, and four quarters of results, it could, financially impact a small utility like that. So we have no data for those three three dots that were located on that map. And I don't believe we plan to require any monitoring at this point.
So in the Camp Pendleton site, there were also, I guess there are public wells because they were shown in blue, out very close to Pendleton to the north, but then up further away from Pendleton to the north. Can you just tell me where those are they protected by the geology of this of the area, or
I'm probably not the best to answer that question. Uh-huh. I can say the base is very large, of course, and they operate almost as two independently separate water distribution system service areas. They have a north area and a south area. The south has the higher results of the two. They both have some relatively high concentrations. I can't say which ones those are on the map, but there's quarterly monitoring of the sources and monthly monitoring at the entry point. All of those sources combine in the north zone. And so we're receiving data on the water that's served to that service area.
I thought that they also got a water source. It's really groundwater under the influence of surface water was farther north, and they may have stopped using that water.
But I can't answer that question.
And going further north, there's San Juan Capistrano, which does get groundwater. So that's why I'm asking, should these places, have they tested? Should they be tested?
There's extensive monitoring throughout Orange County, and we're aware of where the detections are. They're mostly in the north part of the county, in the Anaheim and surrounding county, areas.
The Orange County Water District.
Correct.
Irvine has drinking water wells. There are drinking water wells located in other parts. Okay, those are my questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
Can I ask you a question, please?
Of course, Gary.
Related to the Navy, it looked like from the map that they're, what we know or what we're talking about is their review of their bases. Do we know if they have sampled, or was PFAS part of our sampling of those areas in the bay, particularly over by the carrier piers? Because I know those carriers had a lot of AFFF, and there was I'm sure a lot of it washed over the side. Or is that a particular concern? That would only be from an environmental standpoint, not drinking water. But I'm just curious if we know enough about the Navy's process to know if they have looked at the bay areas, particularly under their docks.
Board Member Strong, this is Roger Mitchell. The Navy has looked into those areas and have for the bases in San Diego have gone ahead and looked at all of the areas where they think that they would be a potential use or distribution of AFFF and PFAS compounds. And part of that has been around the naval ships there, especially the aircraft carriers for it. And so their assessments have looked into that.
Okay, thank you. I just know from my own experience, there's a lot of that stuff washed over the sides over the years.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Other questions? I have a question. I did not get a sense of the magnitude of the problem. The various speakers were very clear on various aspects of human health that are threatened, but at what level? And what is the origin of the PFAS and PFOA? chemicals at this time, if they were banished in the year 2000 or so, where are they coming from?
So I can maybe start and then the team can support me and add in and anything I missed. Getting back to the origin where I had mentioned that there was a phase out, it was really just two of the 6,000 plus chemicals that we are aware are out there. So PFOA and PFOS. PFOA was used a lot in nonstick pans because of kind of the high heat resistance, and PFOS was an active ingredient used in a lot of AFFF, so the aqueous film-forming foams, and they also have stain resistance properties. And so, you know, where there was a phase out of the two that were used the most, there were replacement chemicals. So the idea is that currently we are aware that there's about 6,000 out there, but, you know, depending on who you talk to, you can hear sometimes 7,000. You hear some people talking about 10,000. It really depends in terms of the manufacturers and what they're creating as these replacement chemicals to continue creating the products that they make. In terms of magnitude, that's one thing where these investigations really just started to help us understand the magnitude. So the source investigations were really learning from.
I disagree with you. What your maps show are the distribution of sources, but I didn't see any environmental health investigations or the results of them to indicate the magnitude at which this affects the population. You may have that information, but I didn't see it on their slides.
Correct. And I don't know if Shala, I see you unlocking, but I think that in terms of the magnitude and how it affects the population, that's where we coordinate a lot with our Office of Environmental Health Hazard and Assessment. They're the ones that pretty much take the studies out there of humans who are exposed to PFAS and the chemicals and at what levels and what doses. That's how the lifetime health advisory levels were developed by US EPA. And that kind of drives a lot of the decision-making that we're making from a human health perspective.
Can you give us a specific example? You had a map with hundreds of dots and squares and so forth. Can you give us an example of an area in which there has been an increase or a steady rate of cancer or infection due to eating fish that swim in contaminated waters? There was nothing quantitative that was being presented. It was all qualitative and a little scary, but it's not scary at all if you think about the quality of the measurements. You didn't tell us about that. Are all the labs equally capable? You didn't tell us about that. I have no idea whether to be scared or totally passive about this.
So let me, this is Shaha Farhnak, Assistant Deputy Director of the Division of Water Quality. And those are excellent questions. Our goal today, as you noticed, was we basically were covering some limited background about these compounds, as well as the actions that the State Board, Division of Drinking Water, and the regional boards are taking, so to give the board an understanding of what's going on. But in terms of the toxicological studies and data and the analysis, I would recommend that we could coordinate with Dave Gibson and the team to have them to provide a more detailed presentation on those topics. But in general,
That's quite fair. You're here and we're
So I was going to carry on. But in general, what we know is a lot of the knowledge in terms of the toxicology and the data is based on those two chemicals, PFOS and PFOA. And you are very correct in mentioning, okay, if they've been phased out, why are we still finding it? These chemicals, the whole range of chemicals, are known as forever chemicals. So they don't degrade in the environment. And also, as Annalisa mentioned, all the substitutes could break down to those original compounds. So in terms of what we know and whether we need to be scared or not, given that our priority and the numbers we know currently is relates to the public drinking water supplies, our goal is to make sure that we test what is provided for drinking to public to make sure that they're in compliance with the numbers that and do the reporting that's required with respect to at least the two chemicals that we have toxicological studies and we have response levels and notification levels. Okay. Our source investigation. So
you listed, or excuse me, in the presentation was listed certain numbers of parts per trillion that were limits.
Okay.
What happens when those limits are exceeded? Who is affected? Is it distributed uniformly across the economic and racial population? Is there a environmental justice issue here as well? What are you asking, besides information, which I appreciate, are you asking this water board to take an action? If so, what action or actions are you suggesting we do?
Dave, I'm going to answer part of that question and then also make sure if Jeff has anything to add, I'll give him a chance. The action we are asking the boards, the regional boards to support us is to help us continue doing the source investigation so we know where these are and address the problem at the sources before they get to our public water systems and domestic wells. We are concerned about the domestic wells. We haven't done any testing of those. We know it's a challenge to require testing because of the cost and because of the concern what the regulator is going to do, go to them. So as you notice, and you know that in a lot of the environmental justice areas, we may have more of those wells. So it's the information we're collecting. We're hoping that in coordination and support statewide to get into that phase to figure out how we want to make sure the domestic well owners are also protected as well as small water systems. In terms of the toxicology.
Excuse me. How many personnel from Region 9 should be devoted to these questions that you bring up?
You are asking a very good question. Currently, statewide, we don't have dedicated resources for PFAS, PFOA, and that's why, for this work. So that's why we are prioritizing and doing these as stages. That's why State Board has been issuing statewide orders. And as we get now within like next year or so, middle of next year, we're going to get into a phase where the region is going to be looking at watershed-based analysis to find the connections between the sources and public supply wells. And we are definitely cognizant of the need for resources to focus on the study. So that's something that the higher level management and executive management being discussed. But currently, some of the work the regions are doing as part of the routine, like landfills, as Roger mentioned, as staff mentioned, there's regular monitoring, so they may be incorporating this into that work. The drinking waters, they have some additional resources that they've been focusing on doing this testing. But statewide resource is a challenge. It is a problem that we need to look at, and we need to prioritize.
I'm asking for more PYs. I want to know, how many people do we need to monitor the sites that you have identified to make sure they are not contaminating the human environment? Do we need 10 people? Do we need 100 people? Have you made estimates of that we can actually use? You're talking about collecting information, and that's very important. This region is dedicated to outcomes that improve water quality. What are you asking us to do in detail? And let's not talk about resources. Let's talk about the need to maintain water quality for the population.
So currently, what we are asking the regions, as the data from these landfills, airports, and chrome platers come in, we are asking them to review that data and help us identify and work with the entities on source elimination.
So how do we review data from a chrome plater? Do we take Dave Gibson and send him out to the chrome plater to redo the test to verify that the data is correct? What are we doing?
The data, we have the cleanup programs. We have the MPDS programs, WDR programs, landfill programs, the staff that are working on those programs as part of the data that they would be receiving, it would be this one-time testing. And they'd be reviewing, the same staff will be reviewing that data. And as they determine if there is a need
our
for routine,
is going to go out and retest all those sites to see that the measurements are correct. What are the nobody's going to go out and retest it.
No, we are sending the orders to these facilities. They are doing the testing.
Why should this board believe any of the numbers that you put down if they haven't been tested and error bars assigned to the measurements?
That's a broader question. I think I may not be able to answer, but the laboratories that are doing the test, if that may help, are required to be certified in the use of test methods. So by use of those
data they're collecting have error bars that are small enough that we can believe the numbers that you put down on your slides. You're asking this regional board to do something that you have not personally convinced me is a threat. It may be something that occupies many members of the staffs and state board and regional staff and so, in all regions, but you haven't made a convincing case in my mind that we should do anything. I appreciate the information, but we don't act on all information we get about everything. And this falls into the category of not stimulating and coming up to the level of serious concern for the human population, in my mind. But there's another presentation that has to be given that has that information.
Henry, can I contribute for a minute? The testing methods, I'll tell you, I don't know about San Diego, but I know about Orange County, and I know there's concern. They're given regulatory numbers, which the state enforces. Right now, I think that the total is 70. So if you exceed that, you lose your drinking water source. So that can be a cost. I do know also from my own looking at this information that in the state of Oregon and Washington, they followed some people, and the numbers of these compounds that they had within them decreased over time. I think we have to wait for OHEA to see what if there's going to be a number for us. I think we see that, at least from my looking, not knowing exactly which way the groundwater is going, but we would be interested in the ocean side or whatever it looked like. Maybe it's Ramona that he was talking about. I don't know, but it was south of Camp Pendleton, and I know that Oceanside is south of Camp Pendleton. I also think from looking at the airport, we saw varying concentrations, and we saw where they had their firefighting. They had the highest concentrations moving toward the bay. They had another site that had high concentrations, but nowhere near the firefighting. And then when you crossed over, you saw that the amounts were elevated. So we might want to have, or we might want to ask someone to do some preliminary testing in the bay just to see in the sediment and in the water. Which brings me to my next question, which is they're talking about measuring wastewater. And there is no method that I'm aware of. I heard the state was working on it. I don't know if they've produced that method yet. Maybe you can enlighten that, because the drinking water method probably will not be very good for wastewater. So I think what we want to do, if we want to hear what the health impacts are, we should get someone from OHEA to come down and talk to us, because they give that input. Does that help at all?
Yes. It helps make me more skeptical, yes, that what we have is data that can't be relied on, that hasn't been reproduced, that we don't have the resources to do that, and this board is being asked to do something that it can barely afford to do in the context of the demands, both on the state and on the region, for people.
I think that's true of smaller water systems. The larger water system, like Orange County Water District, they're monitoring their wells. They're looking at them much more frequently than the state is. Mm-hmm. So, but for smaller areas, as you heard, for the small utility, Ramona, yeah, I agree with you. It is a problem. But I think nitrates are also oftentimes a problem.
Yeah. Well, that actually is the cap to my concerns, Betty, that there are many things that are problems, and I haven't been convinced that this pair of chemicals is a problem that we should turn our attention to and turn our attention away from those other problems, frankly.
So right. If I may add a couple of, Celeste, you have a point.
Board members can too. Celeste, yeah. Please. Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, I guess the biggest problem is we don't know what we don't know. PFAS has developed in the last several years as an issue. It's a contaminant of concern, and the State Board is looking into trying to figure out what the magnitude actually is. We do know that, I mean, there's some really major red flags. We know it's a carcinogen. We know that it doesn't biodegrade, so it's around for a long time, but I think we're still at the beginning of our understanding of its impact. So the cautionary tale is to try to see what we can figure out so we know the magnitude. I don't think we have a complete understanding of what that is. The thing that alarms me is wherever it's tested for, it seems to be there. I mean, it's very ubiquitous, and that's a big concern. So I guess my thing is I'd like to keep enough of an interest on this to understand a little bit better so we know what we don't know, at least. There are, like Orange County Water District, like Betty said, is really been aggressive in doing this with PFAS early on and with many others also. But, you know, and they have a body of data, but we don't know too much. I appreciate the State Board taking the lead on this, obviously, and sharing this informational item so that we can be more informed.
Yes.
That's all I have to add. Thank you.
Yes, Henry, if I could offer an insight as well. The science of PFAS and PFOA is still evolving, but we do know that it is a carcinogen and in a concern, particularly at high concentrations. So the initial steps statewide have been to try to identify community drinking water systems at risk and literally to remove wells. I mean, that is the prophylactic, the remedial measure at this point in time, is simply to take certain wells offline and replace those water supply systems with something safer. So at a very basic level, that has been the first cut. We're looking at the pathways and the conveyances, and to the extent there's any fate or transport of the PFAS and PFOA from other systems like wastewater systems, industrial places, and so on. But yes, we have a vast tapestry in front of us and only a few sponges of paint on it to truly understand what that picture is saying. And yes, you are quite correct that the resources that California has applied to this within the water boards have been scant. We are trying to make up the distance with the staffing we have. It's going to be far from satisfying in the long run. We're going to have to be able to frame this for the legislature to provide the resources to do this job right. So we have a lot of work yet ahead of us, and we are still trying to present that in a way that you and the board members in here and in other regions can act upon. In the meantime, Sarah Marin and her staff are attending to the investigative orders and interpreting the results. And we can look at places like the San Diego Airport, where we have numbers that are screaming hot. But fortunately, it's not attached to a community drinking water system, and we see very few, if any, pathways to human exposure so far. So but that's not to say that we should not be concerned.
Maybe we should pick up on two things. One is, if it's ubiquitous, as Celeste reminds us, wherever you go, you find it, pretty soon we'll have closed all the wells in California, and it won't be a threat. We'll just be thirsty.
We might be able to provide treatment.
Orange County Water District has in fact been doing such a good job, and I believe it. Let's hear from them and what they're doing. They're in our region. We know them. We have experience with them. I would like, perhaps, if the board agrees, to have a 15 or 20 minute information session from them and what the issues are in our region and what this board can and what the board cannot do.
So for drinking, I'd be glad to have a name supplied to Dave to be able to bring someone down to give a presentation. I've heard of presentation.
They don't have to come down anymore, Betty.
That's why we're doing it. Well, if we're doing it by conference, yes, they don't need to come down. But they do have a presentation. They have a good presentation. I've heard it. And it might be more informative, but it is pretty much limited to groundwater in their location. And okay. They do know, because for years they took water from the Santa Ana River and recharged their basin, and wastewater was discharged into that. And they think that's one of the sources for their mm-hmm. area. Not necessarily the only source, but one of the sources. So that's easy to do if you would like. And I think you'd like their presentation.
Okay. We do have one more item on the regular agenda, and then we have a closed session to go
Before
to.
Before we move to that, Henry, may I ask one more question? I want to know what method they're going to recommend for wastewater, because there are a lot of compounds that can interfere. We need to know that. I'd like to know this. I'd like to know what they're thinking, since they mentioned it in this presentation.
Okay.
Sure. This is Annalisa. So on the draft order that we currently have for the wastewater treatment plant facility, when we issued the original orders back in 2019, there wasn't a clear method approved by US EPA for non-drinking water matrices. And so we worked with California ELAP on the Department of Defense Quality Systems Manual. So as Wendy had mentioned, they're a lot further ahead when it comes to their sampling, their analysis, and their assessments. So they have a Quality Systems Manual for non-drinking water matrices. That's DOD QSM 5.1, I think table 5.1. I can provide you the actual kind of statement if needed, but we would like, if there were a US EPA approved method for non-drinking water matrices, to have used that. I believe you are mentioning method 1600 is what we're hearing, is currently out for public comment, but no non-drinking water method analysis for PFAS, for the non-drinking water matrices is available to us and has been established by US EPA. So until then, we're using the DOD QSM.
Okay, that's very helpful. I do think, and just to go back to one of Henry's points, there are only very few labs that actually do this testing. And I think for what the reasons Henry mentioned, I don't think that there are that many labs approved in the state, are there? To do PFO and PFAS?
Correct. I think Wendy might have the numbers off the top of her head.
Yeah, there's about six or five, but I wanted to add that to Annalisa, is that a lot of the states across the country are analyzing for PFOA and PFAS, are doing the exact same thing we are in regards to analyzing their wastewater and other non-drinking water methods by utilizing the Department of Defense's QSM. And so essentially it's telling the analytical lab what QA/QC procedures that they have to do and meet those quality standards. So,
well, I know that wastewater plants are trying to look at this themselves, which means that they could have, but if they use the wrong method, it'll be worthless. So try to get us all on the same page there. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Chairman Cavanaugh.
Thank you all. We're going to move on to item number six.
Chairman Barbanel.
This is Megan Blair, too. I just have a comment before we move on.
Just a quick reminder to the board that we do have a public comment that we need to address. So once the board has asked its questions, I propose that we go ahead and we seek to recognize the attendee.
Okay, thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Megan now.
I think I just had a comment or question slash comment, Henry, in thinking about your question of whether or not this is, you know, compared to other things that we're testing and tracking and trying to remove or remediate, if this is a concern to human health. I just was wondering whether there have been lawsuits in the private sector that we could learn from, where there may have been a lawsuit brought against a private entity that in their defense would have tried to argue that it's not something of human health concern. Because we heard in the presentation, you know, both in humans and animals, some of the, you know, reproductive concerns and mm-hmm. concerns. So I was just wondering if maybe there are private sector lawsuits that would help inform us in terms of determining how much.
That's a very good question. And personally, I would go to the NIH and ask them what they know about this.
NIH, no.
You don't have to ask Anthony Fauci, but I'd love to have him come on to our channel here and tell us what's going on. I don't think it falls in his institute, but the NIH, if there are private sector or educational institutions where research on this is going on, they would probably be funding it.
There are publications that have shown where these where towns were located next to industries utilizing these compounds, mm-hmm. that there have been pretty significant health effects. Now that I know, and maybe I read them a while ago. But they certainly track it. But EPA and NIH. Well, NIH would look at the National Cancer Institute, if it's cancer located. But these are like epidemiology studies that they've been done.
That's what OEHA should be looking at as well. I mean,
it should be.
But I don't remember which speaker.
I mean, they have all those studies. They'll probably recite them to us chapter and verse.
Right. And some of them might be right.
Right.
Okay.
Concentration.
I'm going to cut off conversation on this. We need to move on to the next item. So thank you all very much for your presentations and for spending time with us.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, there's a public speaker.
You want to introduce somebody from the public to address us?
Yes, I do. I will be recognizing Matthew Trotter to go ahead and speak.
Will he appear on the screen or something? There he is.
My name is Matthew Trotter, and I just want to reaffirm my concern over this issue as a citizen of the Region 9 District and assert that I believe continued information gathering is crucial to human health and the health of the environment. I also wonder if certain military sites are being prioritized based on the potential threat to human health and the environment around them. Further, it seems like the only information being gathered in Camp Pendleton and the solutions being employed by the Department of Defense are only being used to mitigate effects to human health. Beyond this, it seems like the basis practice of simply mixing PFAS-contaminated water with clean water is not adequate considering the nature of PFAS as a highly mobile contaminant that bioaccumulates. Further, what efforts, if any, are being taken to analyze or remedy the extensive ecological damage that could be caused in the surrounding coastline by PFAS contamination? As a resident of San Clemente, I know ocean recreation bordering Camp Pendleton is exceptionally
probably going to be another 2 hours.
I'm concerned about the potential effects of PFAS contamination in the ocean area. Thank you for hearing my public comment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Trotter. Any questions of Mr. Trotter? Okay. Roger, do we have any other public input?
It doesn't look like we have any other public speakers on this item. Okay. So we can go ahead and get prepared to go ahead and move to the next item if you wish.
If this were an in-person meeting, we'd have a biological break. But since it's not, help yourself. And let's move on to item number 6. Dave, do you want to introduce that item, please?
Yes, this is an update on the Cannabis Cultivation Regulation and Enforcement by Eric Lindberg, the Senior Engineering Geologist and Chief for the South Coast Regional Cannabis Cultivation and Regulatory Unit. That unit serves regions 4, 8, and 9, Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and the San Diego region. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Lindberg will give us an update. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm really pleased to speak with you today. I'm Eric Lindberg. I'm a senior engineering geologist with the Santa Ana Regional Water Board staff. I'm the unit chief of the South Coast Regional Cannabis Regulatory Unit, which represents the Los Angeles, San Diego, and Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Boards. Our unit is a bit unique, as is our program. Not only do we cover a wide variety of different biomes in Southern California, but we also are regulating a fairly new industry, a new legal industry anyway, in California. So allow me to dive in. Let me preface this by saying that this presentation is fairly photo intensive. I realize we're all on small screens thanks to social distancing. So this presentation can be made available for review later. And of course, I'm happy to elaborate on anything that isn't clear as it comes across. So let's go ahead and dive in. Slide, please. Okay. I've spoken to this board before. Forgive me if I move quickly through the regulatory background, but I would like to just touch on a couple of key points. The legalization of recreational cannabis in California came under Proposition 64. Prop 64 passed with an overwhelming majority of voters in California. However, the way that Proposition 64 was implemented in law, cities and counties can permit or prohibit commercial cannabis activities at their own discretion. That's made for a complicated patchwork of pro-grow, no-grow areas. So commercial cultivation, slide please. Commercial cultivation is anything above 6 mature personal use plants grown in your own house for your own personal use. The California Water Boards and the Regional Water Boards don't have any specific regulatory authority over the 6 personal plants. However, once you move beyond that, the scale and the risk of environmental impact due to discharge from cultivation increases. So the water boards developed a program, slide please, to address those environmental risks and working in conjunction with our partner agencies, in particular California Fish and Wildlife, to ensure that licensed cultivators, licensed through the California Department of Food and Agriculture, are exercising the appropriate best management practices to prevent discharges of waste or water supply issues that come with what is a water intensive crop. Now I should point out that this is not a federally recognized crop yet. Industrial hemp under the 2018 Farm Bill is a recognized agricultural commodity. In California, cannabis is legal, federally it is not. So state regulations determine how we approach this. So it's a little bit different than the ag program, though many of the concerns, the water quality concerns in particular, are the same. Slide, please. So if you want to do some homework, order number 2019-001 is the latest and greatest version of the general order and policy. It was updated in April of 2019, so a little over a year ago. The key takeaway is that it establishes requirements for the diversion and use of water, land disturbances, and activities related to cannabis cultivation. In particular, with regard to diversion of surface water resources and land disturbances near riparian corridors. Obviously, there's a lot more to it than that, but if you take that away from this slide, then we're in good shape. Next slide, please. So under that general order, commercial cultivators, again, this is, you know, cultivators, whether indoor or outdoor, over six plants, who intend to, you know, produce that for some sort of distribution. They have to have either waste discharge requirements for outdoor cultivations, a conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for most indoor cultivations. And if there's any surface water use, then there is a water rights component to that, which is covered under the Small Irrigation Use Registration Program at State Board. Slide, please. The regional boards, being your cannabis unit, South Coast Cannabis Unit, we process enrollment applications. We determine the risk and applicability of either the conditional waiver of WDRs or WDRs themselves, particularly for outdoor grows. And those permits, those WDRs or waivers, are issued under the banner of the appropriate regional board. The difference between the conditional waiver and the WDRs is basically the difference between indoor and outdoor grows. The idea being that indoor grows that discharge primarily to community sewer systems or that haul their liquid waste off to a community sewer system are the lowest threat to environmental impact. And as such, then those grows qualify for a conditional waiver. I've also included the fee numbers on here. And I only did that really just to point out the fact that while the industry, the new industry itself is under a tremendous fee load, the water board fees are fairly small, especially compared to some of our other programs. Slide, please. Those fees are scaled to the risk of a grow, and outdoor cultivations are split up into tiers and risks based on size, slope of the planting, and whether or not there's riparian vegetation nearby. Slide, please. Some of the specific considerations that the Water Board program regulates and requires for outdoor cultivation are shown here. Concerns of sediment mobilization, stability, runoff control, and appropriately designed watercourse crossings and so on must be designed by a qualified professional. So for an outdoor grow, there is a significant level of regulatory requirement to make sure that those practices are done in a way that's not causing a cumulative impact to a watershed, whether that be sediment discharge, salt and nutrient discharge, etc. Next slide, please. This is our service area. The South Coast unit, as I mentioned before, covers three regions. Basically, everything from Ventura County down to San Diego County along the coast. Next slide. I have a staff of four. We're engineers and geologists. Our primary role is to enroll, permitted, licensed, eventually licensed cultivators into the program and then ensure compliance with the requirements of the general order. That's job one. However, there's also an enforcement component to what we do. And because of that patchwork that I mentioned earlier about pro-grow and no-grow, we find ourselves in Southern California spending more time on enforcement activities than on enrollment. That has to do with the local municipal governments, in particular, San Diego County, Riverside County, many of the cities, which have chosen not to allow for commercial cultivation, period. So basically any cultivation above and beyond the personal use limit is a criminal violation. It's also a water code violation if there's an unpermitted discharge. So what happens is that we often find ourselves working with law enforcement partners to investigate illicit sites. Believe it or not, the black market is thriving despite legalization. And in particular, in San Diego County, there are quite a few illicit grows. And what I want to show you as we move forward is what the potential environmental impact of those grows is to our watersheds. Slide, please. This map is shows the enrolled, that is to say the permitted cultivation operations in the three regions that I mentioned. By and large, most of the enrolled, licensed, legal cultivation sites are in the city of Los Angeles and the adjoining cities that are pro-grow. Notice that there is a significant sprinkle of sites in the city of San Diego. The city of San Diego has issued a number of permits to indoor growers. And when I say indoor, I'm talking about a warehouse, okay, that has a hydroponic system or a drip irrigation system. It's connected to sewer. We're not talking about greenhouses. That's a different story. And what's shown here on this table is how many of those grows, those permitted grows that are enrolled under the general order program, are discharging to either a community sewer system or a waste hauler. Interesting side note, there are a couple of sites that have proposed some sort of on-site treatment. To date, those are not operating. On-site treatment typically requires a site-specific waste discharge requirement permit. So that's something else. But the takeaway here is that most of these licensed permitted cultivations are discharging to sewer. Slide, please. So focusing in on the San Diego region, I just want to show you what a couple of these grows look like. This is what you can expect if you were to visit a licensed indoor cultivation here in the city of San Diego. This particular grow is Outliers Collective in El Cajon. They have a great facility. We were actually trying to set up a tour that I'd intended to invite board members to, and then COVID hit. So perhaps we can do a virtual thing at some point. But to give you a taste of it, this is their grow. This is what they're doing. They produce high quality flower and associated products that have CBD, THC, etc. The plants themselves are grown as shown here. These are our flood trays. However, you can see the little drip lines. These are, the word flood is a bit of a misnomer because these are very water conscious operations. The idea being that water is expensive. The plants require very specific nutrient balance, and that being efficient is, a good business practice. Notice that there is some discharge coming off of these trays. These are pretty young plants, so they may not be absorbing everything. But the point is that the discharge is there on the floor drain, right? So all the discharge that's coming out of the grow room, when there is discharge, is going to the local utility, the POTWs. Next slide, please. Because the plants are so sensitive and because water is such a big issue, the fertigation systems, which is an irrigation system that delivers nutrified water. These fertigation systems are fairly complicated in many cases. Again, we're looking at this one particular grow in San Diego, in El Cajon. A couple things that I can't easily point to because we're not in the same room. There's several layers of filtration. Oftentimes the water is treated via reverse osmosis before it's nutrified. So, you're taking what is by all accounts high quality municipal water, running it through a small reverse osmosis system to basically make pure irrigation water. And then it's being nutrified. So the salts and nutrients are being added back in to a very specific, TDS limit, nitrate limit, potassium, phosphorus, etc. There's a lot of science to this. It's not just, growing roses in your backyard, although, you probably have some pretty amazing roses with a system like this. So there's a lot that goes into a licensed, well-run indoor facility. Slide, please. This particular facility also does extraction. What that is when either the dried flower product, the leaf material, etc., is put under a high pressure in a high pressure vessel and exposed to a solvent, which removes the oils that you might have seen in over the counter. CBD oil is the all the rage right now, as well as whole plant oil, which contains THC and so on and so forth. That oil can then be used for other products, I think edibles or you name it. So Outliers Collective runs not only a cultivation side, which is what the water boards are interested in, but also this sort of lab setup, and eventually they do a retail front end. Again, it's a very sophisticated operation. The solvent that they use in this particular lab is CO2, which, of course, is a relatively safe gas. Other than an asphyxiation concern, there's no explosivity or anything like that that you might see with some of the illegal labs, which San Diego, fire and hazmat has had some recent responses to butane labs exploding and fires being caused by that. This is an example of a well-run, safe, industrial-scale lab. We often see these kinds of labs associated with cultivations. Next slide, please. Another grow in the San Diego region is Palomar Works. This particular grow is located on the Santa Isabel Tribal land. I guess the Santa Isabel tribe had a casino site that closed down, and they opened up a very elaborate, sophisticated greenhouse setup, and they lease out some of that land to cultivators such as Palomar Works. This is still technically an indoor site because it's a permanent structure with an impermeable floor, and the discharge is entirely to a community-owned sewer system. However, this is a very large scale grow compared to that indoor grow, which is more of the warehouse type that I described a moment ago. It's an impressive operation. Slide, please. At Palomar, they also use drip irrigation. You can see that the plants are grown in, I believe that's a soil medium, although that's not the only option. Drip irrigation looks like a cascading system, from pot to pot, and feeds nutrified water at a certain rate to the plants so that they're grown, big and tall and all that without wasting a whole lot of water and nutrients. Again, this is a cost saving measure. And again, a legal grow is going to be very, conscious of these costs and these pressures. When I get to some of the illegal sites, you'll see a different story. Slide, please. We've seen some pretty interesting developments in pest control at some of these indoor grows. I think this particular sachet shown on the left is, it has a beneficial mite colony. And as those, adolescent mites emerge from the sachet, they prey on the detrimental mites that might come and come to these plants. So it's because of the requirements by Cal Cannabis in the state of California on quality and the testing of these products, the use of pesticides is generally not done for a licensed grow. So we've seen some pretty slick, alternatives. One grow uses ladybugs, which I thought was pretty smart, to eat the mites and keep the pests down. And I don't think anybody would say that ladybugs are an environmental risk, as opposed to, say, carbamate pesticides. Shown on the right is some dried product. I just threw that in there for fun. Next slide, please. Here are some more examples of what an indoor grow looks like. We don't really need to linger on this unless there are questions, so let's keep going. This is a common site for indoor grows. This is where the clones are taken off of the mother plants and grown into new plants. So it's typical that we would see grow rooms, that are relatively small in footprint, have thousands of plants. It's a very dense operation to grow cannabis indoors. Again, notice the humidity control, the moisture control. There isn't a whole lot of runoff here. The plants are being fed what they need. And if anything, there's a solid waste component once the plant is moved from this grow medium to a larger pot, as opposed to a whole lot of liquid discharge. Slide, please. We already kind of discussed the nutrient systems and how complicated they can be and how expensive they can be. Slide, please. The systems are often mixing large quantities of specific nitrate, potassium, and phosphate concentrations at different points within the grow cycle. It's impressive to see this system. On the flip side, if there were to be a discharge of waste to the environment, what we're talking about are potentially highly concentrated fertilizers. It's more than just spilling some Miracle-Gro in your backyard. There is some risk to this, even despite the fact that these are indoor grows. And we'll get to that a little bit more in just 1 second. Next slide, please. This is neat for any nerds out there. The pipe system at this one particular grow in Long Beach, so this is the Los Angeles region, had over 24,000 plants, and I believe they were at somewhere around 50-60% capacity. I think they were still expanding. So this was the control center that watered plants in 52 grow rooms in what, if you drove past it, just looks like an Amazon warehouse or something. Next slide, please. Additional irrigation methods include true flood tables, hand watering. Again, typically for indoor grows, there's still a lot of control over where that water goes and how much is being used. Next slide. This is a drip system combined with a flood tray. The dosing is very highly controlled. But note the scale that's kind of built up on the top of that drip tray. These nutrient inputs are high in salts, high in nutrients. And we actually, our unit, along with the Eastern California Cannabis Unit, are working on a pilot program to test indoor effluent to kind of characterize what these inputs to the POTW systems are. So far, we've seen some pretty interesting concentrations. I think some of the nitrate concentrations were unbelievably high. That's the danger of a low dose of fluid and the associated buildup of those salts and nutrients that aren't uptaken by the plant. Next slide, please. These are some of the various discharge points we've seen at indoor grows. It can be as simple as running pipes from the grow rooms to the nearest sink, what's the capacity of that sink? 10 gallons, it's quite small. But the discharge is often a trickle. You can see in the photo on the right that, there are droplets coming out of the discharge pipe. So unless there's a flood tray that's being washed on, let's say, a weekly basis, the general discharge to the POTW systems is this sort of high concentration, low volume trickle, okay? Is not similar to agricultural inputs. So indoor cultivation is a very different animal. Next slide, please. These are some more examples of floor drains and drips. We can keep moving. Next slide, please. This was a site, I believe this was in the Santa Ana region, but it was right near the boundary between regions 8 and 9. This is an indoor grow. They were following all those best practices inside the grow itself. My inspectors found this creek basically coming off of the property. We investigated that. We talked with the discharger. Obviously, this isn't okay. This is an unpermitted discharge to the storm drain system. They assured us that all waste discharge was going to the sewer. When we pointed out the algae-rich torrent of water coming out of their back lot. They said, oh, well, that's not waste. That's where we wash the grow medium. And obviously, they may have misunderstood what waste meant, because this is the high nutrient, high salt, buildup being washed out of the grow medium so that they could use the medium again. This is exactly what we don't want to see released into the environment. So despite the fact that indoor grows are given a conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements, our regulatory oversight is important. There is an environmental risk to these indoor grows. In this particular case, we worked with the city to have the operation cited for their discharge. We sent them a letter ordering them to, you know, cease and desist, and they've taken steps to not rinse off their grow medium out behind the warehouse. So next slide, please. So if we move from the permitted sites to the licensed illicit, or excuse me, the unlicensed illicit sites, the black market sites, you'll notice that the distribution is very different compared to the map I showed earlier with the enrolled sites being concentrated in Los Angeles and San Diego. Every red dot shown on this map is an illicit cannabis site that was inspected by our staff. This is not by any means comprehensive. I believe that in region nine, in the San Diego region, there are around 140 sites that my staff have inspected. These are illicit black market sites. We inspected those sites as part of a search warrant with, criminal investigators and law enforcement. And I think you might be kind of surprised at the difference in cultivation practices at these sites. So this is a big problem. Again, note the distribution. We're talking about more of the wilderness grows. We're talking about rural communities. We're talking about basically almost exclusively outdoor grows. So these are greenhouses, hoop houses, sometimes just planted right in the ground. And there are many of them. Next slide, please. Focusing on the San Diego region, those same enforcement sites are shown here in the yellow circles with the little crosshairs. So we've zoomed into only the San Diego region, shown in the gold outline. The blue sub-watersheds are the high-quality, high-priority stream systems as identified in the Region 9 Basin Plan. Note the correlation between where these grows are and what these, you know, high-quality waters, where they're located. You'll notice that many cases we have cultivations right in those watersheds, and in other cases, we have them up gradient of main stem, streams and rivers. Next slide, please. And we'll get back to that in 1 second. Just to give you some idea of what those enforcement characteristics are.
Much longer do you expect to be presenting?
I can make it as short as you like, Mr.
Well, no, I don't want you to cut out important material. It's been very pictorial, as you promised, but we also have to go into a closed session soon. So let's give it another 5 to 7 minutes.
I think that sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so next slide, please. And actually one more. Let's just jump to the map. This is more informative. So these are those same high quality watersheds overlain with those enforcement sites, and many of these are sites that we have been informed of as part of the San Diego Narcotics Task Force. So we haven't visited all these sites, but notice the concentration. It's right around the Santa Margarita watershed. It's right around the San Juan watershed, etc. This map also shows the landowners that we're working with to try to get these sites cleaned up. Next slide. This is another aspect, similar map, but now we're talking about water, Clean Water Act 303D listed water bodies, in particular for nutrients and pesticides. So note that the cluster of yellow dots is, in many cases, at the headwaters of these 303D listed water bodies. So these illicit grows are potentially a big problem. Slide, please. This summarizes what the map showed. In particular, we're looking at nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfates, that is to say nutrients, and salt discharges. Next slide. The issues that we see at these illicit grows are that they do use pesticides. So we're not seeing the ladybugs. We're not seeing the sachets of mites. We're seeing non-EPA registered, non-approved, often foreign imported pesticides used at some of these sites. I mean, this is stuff that you wouldn't want anywhere near your children, your wildlife. It's really bad stuff in many cases. And here's some of the other environmental concerns. As you can imagine, irresponsibly maintained grows contribute to litter, waste, discharges of various things, including sediment. Next slide, please. This is a site in Awonga. I can assure you that red algal bloom is not normal. It's not natural. That's indicative of a release of nutrients to what should be a nice pond adjacent to the property. Next slide. We see discharges of irrigation tailwater that are intentionally pushed into waters of the state. Next slide. This is a pond out behind a grow. Same thing, algae. Next slide. The problem is that at that particular grow, we also found some of these banned pesticides and chemicals. Carbofurin is banned for use in the United States. We see it frequently at the illicit grows. It's highly toxic to humans. It's even more toxic to wildlife. One tablespoon can kill a fully grown adult black bear. It's really nasty stuff. And oftentimes the officers dealing with these things are exposed and require medical attention. Next slide. This is an example of carbofurin as it's being applied to plants. This is in the San Diego region. This was just a couple months ago. This particular grow, this is a discharge of a banned pesticide immediately adjacent to a waterway. Next. Let's go ahead and skip three more slides. I can just summarize that what we're talking about here is erosion into waterways, discharge of sediment, nutrients from various applications, as well as theft of water from some of the natural springs that we see up near Mount Palomar. And just to drive all that home, human waste is a big part of some of these grows. And it's obviously very disgusting. And it kind of hits home that there are discharges of potentially hazardous things happening at some of these sites. That's about it. Next slide is my contact info if you have any questions, and obviously I'm here to answer them now.
Okay, thank you, Eric. Are there questions of Eric?
I just have a quick question. Eric, I'm sorry, I don't recall if you did the presentation for us back in September 2018, where we talked about similar issues, and I guess I'm wondering, is it possible to provide today or come back to us and either by way of executive officer's report or an informational item on the status, the progress on enforcement? Because in our presentation in September 2018, we saw horrific pictures of environmental or like outside illicit grows where these banned pesticides were being used and it was too toxic to send officers into those grow sites. And so, you know, some time has passed. I'm wondering sort of like we've known that's a problem now for clearly a long time. What are we doing in terms of actual cleanup, setting aside the enforcement part of it?
Right. I mean, without going into any particular case that may come before your board in the future, I will say that we've had a significant initial move towards voluntary cleanup from many of the sites that are privately owned. The difficulty is that many of the dots on that map that I showed are public lands in one way or another. Getting funding for that obviously is not a water board thing. I mean, we can't be grant applicants and stuff in our own right. But county DEH and others are looking into some of these programs to try to get some cleanup done. It's a target-rich environment. There's a lot of sites that need attention. We're doing what we can when there's a landowner that we can approach to have a site restored. But those public lands grows, that's an unanswered question at this point.
still, even, I mean, not to say that a year and a half or almost 2 years is a long time, but it seems like, you know, to borrow, Henry was asking some pretty pointed questions today about why are we spending resources on this particular, these particular constituents when we're not sure about the human health and safety concerns. Here, there's clear understanding of what we're dealing with. These pesticides have been banned and we're not resourcing the cleanups.
Yeah. There is movement. It's, you know, inertia is tough to overcome. But the governor's office has, you know, taken steps. You know, this was before the May revised budget, so I'm not sure what the status is. Sure. But there have been steps taken to address this at a state level, knowing that there are impacts from, you know, black market grows and that cleaning those up is a difficult problem. Hopefully, we'll see some of that actually make it through into next fiscal year. And fiscal years, you know, going forward.
At the risk of asking one more question and a naive question at that, how much of it do you think is education on banned pesticides versus, you know, ladybugs or even pesticides that are still on the market?
You know, there's a stark difference between, you know, the permitted indoor grows that are, you know, controlled by their municipal governments. And, you know, by ordinance, there are certain requirements versus what's just the easiest method to grow plants. I mean, the difference is really night and day. I do think that there's a certain correlation between many of the outdoor cultivations we've run across and organized crime, which is involved with some of the smuggling operations that bring these chemicals into Southern California. And we're working with US EPA on those issues, those pesticide smuggling issues, because that's not really our thing. That's, you know, more of a national problem. However, I don't think that it's simply a matter of ignorance by the cultivators. I think that they're using the most effective tool that they can. And of course, that's very disturbing because whether they realize it or not, these are very dangerous chemicals to be applying, and they're not being applied in a responsible manner. I mean, painted onto the stalks of those plants. That's, you know, these should be diluted far more than they are. They should be applied with a sprayer. I mean, there's a lot of things they could be doing a lot better, and there just doesn't seem to be any, you know, willingness to do that.
Thank you for your presentation.
Should the regional board open up a school of safe cannabis growth?
Like, it's not the worst idea.
You have a lot of customers. Are there other questions of Eric?
This is Eric.
Oh, Eric Anderson has a question for Eric Lindberg.
There we go. One of the feedback I'm getting these days from the highly regulated permitted people is that the price points have declined to the point where it's very difficult for them to operate economically, while the black market guys seem to spring up and just go forward and are able to undercut them. And so it's just a criticism. I'm glad there is enforcement out there. But my main question is, there's the Ag Commissioner has about 100 permitted industrial hemp growers and some greenhouse and some outdoor. I don't know how are you addressing that? Are you running into anything? And I do see a huge decrease in the outdoor illegal grows just because the price has gone down so much and it's not worth it anymore.
Two really good points there. The black market undercutting the legal market that was a problem that was anticipated. However, resources, that is to say law enforcement resources, have been allocated in such a way, at least in Southern California, that the focus is more on the retail side of things. So, illicit dispensaries popping up. Now, in theory, that should trickle down to, you know, illegal cultivators not having a place to sell their goods, as, you know, cities and counties are successful in targeting those illegal retail businesses. However, what that style of enforcement doesn't address is the black market cultivation that eventually leaves California. That's still a thriving thing, and pinching retail doesn't really stop that. California provides, you know, cannabis for a lot of the country. There's a significant volume of material leaving the state. Switching gears to hemp, hemp is an interesting thing. In the past, it was grown for, you know, fibers and textiles and things like that. Most of the hemp being grown now is being grown for CBD oil extraction. So these are the non psychoactive CBD products that are very much in vogue. So a hemp plant, the difference between cannabis and hemp is negligible. The one measurable thing is the THC content. So if you can grow a hemp plant at less than 0.03% THC that's high in CBD, it's indistinguishable as you stand there from a cannabis plant. It still has flowers. It's still a female plant. It smells the same. Your neighbors will think you're growing cannabis. Obviously that is regulated as a legal licensed agricultural commodity now, as of the 2018 Farm Bill. So it has all of the non-point protections that agriculture has. So the regulation of hemp, legal licensed hemp, now falls to the agricultural program. The same way that, if you were growing a row of corn, you'd have to comply with the ag order. That certainly applies for hemp as well.
Other questions?
I have one question. I just wanted to ask, in national forests or state forests, are they particularly targeted? And what about Southern California? I mean, is that considered?
You mean targeted by the growers or by the enforcers?
By the growers. The enforcers follow the growers, I hope.
So historically, Northern California, the North Coast, has been, the hot spot for growing cannabis. I, in my opinion, that's more to do with the availability of water rather than something having to do with the climate. Although, cannabis is very happy to be in that North Coast climate. So as legalization kicked off, the black market in Southern California is not new. However, certain communities like Anza, the Owanga area, have seen a big move in the last 2 years of landowners land purchases specifically for illicit cultivation. It's not ubiquitous across Southern California. It also seems to follow the availability of water, particularly a plot of land that has good sun exposure with a groundwater well that's already installed is ideal for growing cannabis, because a fully grown mature cannabis plant in soil can take several gallons of water per day. It's a very water intensive crop. When you're on municipal water, that doesn't work out. It doesn't pencil out as well. So we see the black market cultivation in particular gravitating towards those areas. And it is a big problem in Southern California.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't see any other hands. Thank you, Eric Lindberg and Eric Anderson, for your question. Roger, do we have any members of the public? I see Craig Carlisle's name down, and I recognize his name from a previous meeting.
Yes. Chairman, we do not have any comments from the public. Craig is the senior over that particular program here out of our region.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking for somebody from the public, I think, with a very close name. Anyway.
We don't have any other comments, and we can proceed to closed session.
Okay. So I don't know what formal thing we're supposed to do, but let's close the regular meeting. And Catherine, do you need to say
yes.
Something about our moving to closed session?
Yeah, I would.
Good luck. Yes.
Like to announce that you're going to be talking about the San Diego Water Board versus International Boundary and Water Commission litigation during closed session today.
Okay.
You're on mute, Henry.
All right, we have to close down the Zoom meeting and move over to a Microsoft Teams meeting. Just as a personal matter, I found that the easiest way to do that is to go to the Water Board email site, and there's a little calendar on it. If you click on the calendar, your connection to Teams should appear, and you can try to become a member of the Teams meeting. So let's take...
Do you want to provide an estimate on when you might be back?
It's 11:50. Why don't we see if we can do it by 12 o'clock? How long will the closed session go? Does anybody have an estimate of that?
Henry, it will probably take about 15 to 20 minutes, depending on the amount of discussion or questions the board members have for the attorneys.
Okay, I'll take that as 30 to 45. And why don't we move over to Teams now? And I'll see you soon.
With luck.
Resolution. If we don't know where our partners stand, I thought we did. So good.
We are being recorded and we are live, just so you know.
Yeah, let's be careful about that.
We are online.
I will never get used to Zoom calls.
Me neither. I don't want to.
All right. Get four people. Yep.
Four. We got four.
Go for it, Henry.
Okay. There's nothing to report out from the closed session. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have a good day, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care.
Be safe, everybody. Mm-hmm.